Welcome to a Talk Nation radio special. I'm Dory Smith. On Wednesday, we aired part one of a talk by noted scholar and author Norman Finkelstein. The talk was given April 7th at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. Norman Finkelstein's talk was sponsored by the Arab Cultural Association, the Muslim Students Association, Ideals United, and the Iranian Students Association. During the first half hour, he outlined his reasons for calling what happened in Gaza a massacre rather than a war.
On one side, on the Palestinian side, the best figures we now have are 1,450 Palestinians were killed, of whom approximately 83%, about 980 Palestinians, were civilians, about 311 were children. On the other side, on the Israeli side, there were 13 casualties, of whom 3 were civilians, 10 were combatants, and of those 10 combatants, about half were killed due to friendly fire, that is, Israeli soldiers accidentally shooting Israeli soldiers.
He said Israel's January election may not have been as much of a factor as some theorized, arguing instead that Israeli leaders were more interested in demonstrating their force in the region as a quote-unquote deterrent. He said as of November 2008, Palestinian rocket attack levels had gone down. Palestinians were adhering to a ceasefire. Thus, Israel's rocket attacks in November were, according to Finkelstein, an intentional provocation. He argued that the Israeli breach of a ceasefire was over peace, not war, therefore, claiming Israeli leaders did not want to settle for the limits of any peace agreement with Hamas or other Palestinian groups that might cause Israel a loss of land, of occupied regions of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. You can find part one online by going to our website, talknationradio.org and .com. Professor Norman Finkelstein is author of several books, including The Holocaust Industry, Image and Reality of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, and Beyond Chutzpah.
So let's look at the first reason. Israel needed to restore its deterrence capacity. About a week into the massacre, the chief New York Times correspondent in the Middle East, a fellow named Ethan Bronner, he said that Israel's larger concern was to establish Israeli deterrence, because Israel's enemies are less afraid of it than they once were or should be. The problem was reestablishing Israeli deterrence. Now, some of you are still a little bit confused by that, and you're allowed to be. In fact, this notion of restoring deterrence capacity has always been very central to Israeli strategic doctrine. And it's the deterrence capacity, or the need to restore it, is actually how we got to where we are today. Some of you may know that Israel acquired or occupied the West Bank and Gaza in June 1967. It was said back then in June 67, and it's been said most of the time since then. I don't know what Professor Pressman teaches in his classes, but it's still said that the reason Israel went to war in June 1967, that is the aftermath they acquired Gaza and the West Bank, the reason they went to war was because, as the famous Israeli foreign minister put it, Abba Eben, he said it was a case of to live or to die. Israel was threatened with extinction in June 1967. It had no option except to retaliate, and then in the course of retaliation, it occupied the Gaza and the West Bank. How many of you have heard that story or are familiar with it? In June 67, it was to live or to die. Raise your hand so I know how many people are. Okay, good. So it's about, we estimate, about a third to a half. It's a very dramatic story. The problem is it has very little to do with reality. The reality, as I understand it, and I'll be happy to document it, goes something like this. In May 1967, Israel was threatening to attack Syria, and in fact had already taken a cabinet decision to attack Syria. Syria at that point was allied with Egypt, which was led by this fellow named Gamal Abdel Nasser. And when Nasser got wind of the fact that there was going to be an attack on Syria, his ally, he took basically two initiatives. Number one, he moved troops into the Sinai Peninsula, which borders Israel. And number two, a few weeks later, he declared a blockade of the Straits of Tehran, through which vessels headed for the Israeli port city of Eilat could no longer pass. At least that's what Nasser said. Those were the threats that Israel allegedly faced. In the real world, it's something like this. He said that because of this blockade, Israel was forced to breathe with a single lung. It was a very dramatic image, but again, the reality did not live up to it, because leaving aside a half dozen other points, the fact is, after a couple of days, there was no blockade of the Straits of Tehran. Nasser was letting vessels pass through. Like many an Arab leader, Mr. Nasser was a windbag. He talked more than he did, and he was threatening the blockade, but after about a couple of 2 to 3 days, there was no longer a blockade. And the Israelis acknowledged that the blockade, as they put it, was a secondary factor in their decision. Well, what about those Egyptian troops poised in the Sinai for an attack on Israel? Here the record is fairly clear, because Israel then, as now, can never do anything without a U.S. green light, or at least a yellow light. And so in May 1967, Israel sent its generals, its diplomats, and its intelligence people to the United States to try to convince the administration of Lyndon Johnson that we're about to be destroyed and we have to attack. Well, Johnson said, give us your data. Let's see what your intelligence information is. And they fed all the data to Johnson, and then Johnson proceeded to take all of this data and give it to about a half dozen U.S. intelligence agencies. And all the U.S. intelligence agencies came back with the same two conclusions. Number one, the intelligence agency said, Nasser is not going to attack. There's no evidence that Nasser is going to attack. And number two, they concluded, if by some weird twist of fate he does attack, Johnson said to the Israelis, according to our intelligence, you will, and I'm quoting Johnson now, you will whip the hell out of them, which, as you know, is exactly what did happen a few days later. Okay, that's what the Americans thought. What did the Israelis think? In fact, we know exactly what the Israelis thought, because on June 1st, 1967, just a few days before the 67 war, the head of Israel's main external intelligence organization, the Mossad, the head was a fellow named Major General Meir Amit, he came to Washington. And he said to the Americans, after they presented their conclusions, one, Nasser's not going to attack. And two, if he does, you'll whip the hell out of them. After the Americans presented their information to him, he said, quote, there were no differences between the U.S. and the Israelis on the military intelligence picture or its interpretation. So the Israelis knew he wasn't going to attack, and they knew if he did, the Israelis would whip the hell out of him. Well, why did they do it then? Why did they attack in June 67? It's the same problem, as I'll return to later, what happened in Gaza. It was the problem of the deterrence capacity. Because back then, there was a fellow well before the time of about half the audience, this guy named Gamal Abdel Nasser. And he was the main bogey, the boogeyman in the Arab world. They used to call him the Hitler on the Nile. And he was sort of like the Islamic fundamentalist today, sort of like Iran, the person you're supposed to hate. And the problem was not that he was an Islamic fundamentalist, like, say, the leadership in Iran. The problem was that he was what they called back then a radical Arab nationalist. And a radical Arab nationalist was a person who essentially had this crazy idea that the Arab people should have the right to decide their own destiny. So that made you a radical Arab nationalist. And then there was another crazy idea that went along with it, that the Arabs should have a right to determine the destiny of our, meaning American, resources, which by some strange quirk of fate were under Arab soil. And that was just not to be. And so this guy had to be gotten rid of, this Nasser guy. The special assistant to President Johnson back then was a fellow named Walt Rostow. And about a couple of days before Israel launched its attack, he said, this Nasser guy, and I'm quoting him, he's got to be cut down to size because he's disrupting our little stewardship of the Arab world. He's got to be cut down to size. And that was the Israeli view as well, that Nasser was whipping up the masses. In May 67, he says he's going to close the Straits of Tehran. The Arabs were getting this weird idea that they didn't have to follow Israeli orders. And the natives were getting restless. They were getting too uppity. And they had to be cut down to size. And there's only one way to cut an Arab down to size, because they only understand the language of force. So every few years, you have to take out the big club and break their skull. And that's basically what restoring deterrence capacity means, reminding the Arabs who's in charge. Back then, there was a divisional commander who later became a prime minister of Israel, namely Ariel Sharon, and he said in 67, we've got to attack Nasser because Israel is losing its deterrence capacity, our main weapon, the fear of us. So we now can be grateful to Ariel Sharon for translating a political science-y term, deterrence capacity, into the language which we all understand, the fear of us. Deterrence capacity means you have to restore the fear of us in the Arab world, sort of like the mafia every once in a while has to break somebody's kneecaps to remind the people in the neighborhood who's in charge. That's the mafia restoring deterrence capacity. That's how we sort of, the beginning of how we got here today in June 67. And basically, Israel faced the same problem as it did in 1967. The problem began in the year 2000, when Israel, which had been occupying parts of Lebanon from 1983, Israel suffered a major defeat when the Lebanese resistance, the Party of God, Hezbollah, ejected Israel from South Lebanon. And when Israel was ejected from South Lebanon, the Hezbollah was not shy about flaunting its victory and telling the Arabs that this is the beginning of a new era and that we no longer fear Israel. Well, that's a problem for Israel. The fear of us has dropped a notch. Israel has to restore its deterrence capacity. And immediately after the end of the first, immediately after Israel was expelled from Lebanon in 2000, it began preparing for another war. And in 2006, the summer of 2006, Israel found its pretext and it launched a major attack on Lebanon, unleashed the full fury of its air force, and prepared a ground invasion. Some of you in the room will remember it was in July and August 2006. It lasted for about 34 days. But for Israel, it was a complete and total, a comprehensive and catastrophic disaster. Their defeat at the hands of Hezbollah was even greater than during the guerrilla war. It's impossible now to go through the full picture, but just to give some sense of the magnitude of the defeat Israel suffered, they had prepared about 30 to 40,000 troops for their ground invasion in Lebanon. The Hezbollah resistance consisted of about 2,000 regular troops and about 4,000 irregular troops. And what was even more disastrous for Israel was it suffered a defeat in the ground war, even though it never even faced the crack Hezbollah troops, which were stationed on the Litani River waiting for an Israeli invasion that never happened. The Israeli army was basically defeated by village militias along the border with Israel. The Air Force was unable to stop the Hezbollah rocket attacks. And in total, Israel delivered or fired about 162,000 weapons in those 34 days. Hezbollah, in all 34 days, fired about 5,000 rockets, which is to say, on any one day of the war, Israel fired or delivered as many weapons as Hezbollah did throughout the war, in the whole of the war. It was a complete and total disaster for Israel. And Israel now began contemplating another attack on Hezbollah. Their attitude was, we're down, but we're not yet out. Unfortunately for them, they didn't yet have a military option against Hezbollah. And so about a year ago today, roughly around this time a year ago, Israel tried to conscript the United States for an attack on Iran. Israel hoped that by knocking out Iran, they could also knock out Hezbollah, which seemed to be reliant or dependent on support from Iran. The United States said no. It didn't give the green light to Israel to attack. Then some of Israel's semi-official emissaries, people like the historian Benny Morris, went around saying that if the United States doesn't attack with conventional weapons, then Israel was going to go into Iran with unconventional weapons, i.e. nuclear weapons. The U.S. still said no go. Well, now Israel had there was all of this bluster from Israel about they're going to attack Iran, which they never did. And Iran went its merry way. So Israel's deterrence capacity dropped another notch. And the leader of the Hezbollah, Sheikh Nasrallah, as I said, kept rubbing it into the face of the Israelis that we're not afraid of you. come and attack. We're not afraid. And for Israel, this was a big problem, that they seemed to be losing their fear of Israel. And that's where Gaza enters the picture. Israel needs to find a defenseless target to annihilate in order to restore its deterrence capacity. And Gaza has always been Israel's favorite shooting gallery. Even there, the feebly armed Islamic movement Hamas had defiantly resisted Israeli dictate, and in June 2008, it even compelled Israel to agree to a ceasefire. Well, Gaza is the designated target for Israel to restore its deterrence capacity. But then how is it going to do it? You can't restore, or Israel couldn't restore its deterrence capacity by defeating Hamas militarily, because Hamas had no military to speak of. It's not going to inspire fear in the Arab world if you defeat Hamas on the battlefield, because there is no battle with Hamas. So how do you restore deterrence capacity? And the way Israel intended to restore deterrence capacity is by causing so much destruction of civilian life and civilian infrastructure that it will convey to the Arab world that Israel is crazy. And if you mess with Israel, it will simply demolish everything in sight. That was their strategy. And they had a name for it. Beginning in 2007, they began referring to what they called their Dahya strategy. Now, is there anyone here from Lebanon? Good. Okay, so you will know that the southern suburb of Beirut is often called the Dahya. It consists mostly of poor Shia Muslims who are very supportive politically of Hezbollah. And in the 2006 war, Israel turned the Dahya into a parking lot. It leveled everything. I had a chance to visit it a little over a year ago, and it sort of looked like the bombed out cities of Europe during World War II after the terror bombing, just the shell of some buildings and then these very deep craters where apartment buildings once were. Israel was very thrilled with what it did in the Dahya. And it began, as I said, in mid-2007 to speak of the Dahya strategy. What was that strategy? Well, the head of the Israeli Northern Command, he said, describing our strategy, the Israeli strategy, we shall pulverize the 160 Shiite villages in Lebanon that have turned into Shiite army bases. We shall not show mercy when it comes to hitting the national infrastructure. An Israeli colonel said, in the event of another war, we need to act immediately, decisively, and with force that is disproportionate. The Israeli Minister of Interior said in September 2008 that in the event of a Hamas rocket attack, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, the Israeli Army, should decide on a neighborhood in Gaza and level it. That was the strategy. And as the massacre unfolded, the Israelis were quite forthright about exactly what they were doing. A reserve general said, what we have to do is act systematically with the aim of punishing all the organizations that are firing the rockets and mortars, comma, as well as the civilians who are enabling them to fire and hide. And it has to be said, it was an impressive show by the Israelis. In the first 2 days of the Lebanon War, Israel killed about 55 Lebanese civilians. But Israel, in what its newspapers called their display of shock and awe, Israel in 4 minutes, of the first day of the Gaza massacre, it killed 200 Gazans. Several days into the massacre, an Israeli strategic analyst said, the IDF, the Israeli army, which planned to attack buildings and sites populated by hundreds of people, did not warn them in advance to leave, but intended to kill a great many of them, and succeeded. Some Israelis were quite thrilled by this display of Israeli shock and awe. There's the case of that sometime historian and full-time propagandist, Benny Morris. On the second day of the Israeli massacre, he wrote in the Times with pride at Israel's highly efficient air assault on Hamas. Not all Israelis were so impressed as Benny Morris. There's a very good Israeli columnist named B. Michael, and he said, I don't think it's very impressive to dispatch helicopter gunships and jet planes over a giant prison and firing at its people. Who were these people whom Benny Morris is so impressed, the precision attack? Well, the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, who covers the occupied territories for the main Israel's most respected paper, Haaretz, he said, who were they? Well, for example, he said, 70 traffic cops at their graduation ceremony, young men in desperate search of a livelihood who thought they'd found it in the police and instead found death from the skies. Was it an accident? Was it the fog of war? Was it an error in execution? No, the Israeli papers reported that Israeli strategists debated for 6 months whether or not to attack that graduation ceremony. And there was some debate whether it was legal to incinerate traffic cops at their ceremony. And then they decided afterwards, at the end, they decided it's fine and dandy, and they went in and blew them away. As Israel targeted schools, mosques, hospitals, ambulances, and UN sanctuaries, as it flattened entire neighborhoods, as it slaughtered and incinerated Gaza's defenseless civilian population, Israeli commentators can barely restrain their gloating. One said, Gaza is to Lebanon as the second sitting for an exam is to the first. A second chance to get it right. And this time around, Israel, it's hurled Gaza back not a mere 20 years as it did in Lebanon, it hurled Gaza back 60 years, back into the 1940s. Electricity is available only for a few hours a day. Another said, Israel regained its deterrence capabilities because the war in Gaza has compensated for the shortcomings of the 2006 Lebanon War. Notice, there's not even a pretense that it had anything to do with rocket attacks. It had everything to do with trying to restore the Arab world's fear of Israel.
You're listening to a talk given by Norman Finkelstein, April 7th, at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut.
A third said, there is no doubt the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah is upset these days. There will no longer be anyone in the Arab world who can claim that Israel is weak. And it's true. Who can now claim that Israel is weak? Who can doubt that it is strong and courageous, heroic and brave? It caged in behind barbed wire and concrete walls, a teeming refugee population. Gaza is about 80%, consists of approximately about 80% refugees and their children. Half of that population is under 16 years of age. It deprived this captive population of food, medicine, and other basic necessities, reducing it to abject despair, that human dignity crisis. It then sent in its jet planes, its helicopter gunships, its tanks, and its armored personnel carriers. It sprayed entire civilian neighborhoods with white phosphorus. Not sure how many of you know what white phosphorus is, and I'll confess, until recently reading the human rights reports, I didn't know quite what it was. White phosphorus is usually used during war as what's called an obscurant. That just means as a kind of camouflage. When white phosphorus makes contact with oxygen, it creates smoke. And then the smoke is used to obscure your enemy's sight of you. But it also reaches a temperature of, believe it or not, it's hard to conceive, a temperature of 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And it burns away your skin, often to your bone, it burns away. Israel dropped from the air the white phosphorus over a hospital, over a UN school, which was a refuge for about 1,600 Palestinians who fled to it during the massacre, over a major UN warehouse, which was a refuge to about 700 Palestinians. It was not using it as an obscurant. We know that for sure for several reasons. Number one, Israel manufactures smoke shells. If it wanted an obscurant, the smoke to cloud the sight of the enemy, it could have used its smoke shells. Number two, the places where Israel dropped the white phosphorus, there were no Israeli troops in sight. They were not dropping it to obscure the view of the enemy, because there were no Israeli troops there. And number three, if it wanted to obscure troops, it would have dropped it on the ground, not in the air. It dropped it over the hospital, Al-Quds Hospital, over UN, the UN Beit Lahia School, over the UNRWA Center, in many civilian neighborhoods and villages for one reason, to use as an incendiary weapon, to incinerate the flesh of those who were occupying those sites. So, heroic, brave Israel, it sent in its jet planes, its helicopter gunships, its tanks, and its armored personnel carriers. It sprayed entire civilian neighborhoods with white phosphorus. Incidentally, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Physicians for Human Rights in Israel have all concluded that what Israel did was a war crime. It then proceeded to slaughter and incinerate this defenseless population. Who can now claim that Israel is weak? One person who was very thrilled by what Israel did was the New York Times chief foreign correspondent, a fellow who goes by the name of Thomas Friedman. And Thomas Friedman always likes to tell everybody that everybody's got it wrong, he's got it right. We simple-minded people think the world is round, but he, knowing much better, tells us it's flat. And during the Gaza massacre, Thomas Friedman said that people got the Lebanon war all wrong. He said it's not true that Israel lost the war with Hezbollah in 2006. He and said, in fact, they won the war because, he said, Israel had managed to inflict substantial property damage and collateral casualties on Lebanon at large. It educated the Hezbollah, and the education was that the Hezbollah would think three times next time before defying Israel. That's how you educate Arabs. You know, when most of you know from your political science courses or even from commonsensical wisdom that the definition of terrorism is when you target civilians and civilian infrastructure to achieve a political goal. That's the definition of terrorism. But that's terrorism when it comes to normal, mortal human beings. When it comes to Arabs, when you target civilians and civilian infrastructure, that's called education. No Arab left behind. And Mr. Friedman said during the massacre in Gaza, he said what Israel was trying to do, and I'm quoting him again, it was trying to educate Hamas by inflicting a heavy death toll on Hamas militants and heavy pain on the Gaza population. That's how you educate these people. You inflict heavy pain on them. Of course, Mr. Friedman doesn't want to come across as an outright Nazi and thug, even though he is one. So he has to come up with a justification for what he did. And so he says, you have to understand, the problem is the way these Arabs fight, especially these Islamic types. They're such cowards. They, as he puts it, they nest among the civilians. They're embedded in the civilians. They're intertwined with civilians. And what's beautiful Israel to do? Of course, it's anguished and it's pained, because we all know that Israel is the longest running soap opera as Israel turns, but they have no choice. They have to kill these civilians, not because they want to, but because those nasty, demonic, Islamic fundamentalists, they're nested among them. That's what we're told. How many people have heard that story? Raise your hand. Okay, good. So it's about a little less than half. What do the facts show? In fact, there's an extensive record on Hezbollah's conduct in war. Let's begin with Human Rights Watch, one of the two leading human rights organizations in the world. They did a study of the 2006 Lebanon War, and this is what they found. And now I'm quoting verbatim, word for word, quote, "We found strong evidence that Hezbollah stored most of its rockets in bunkers and weapon storage facilities located in uninhabited fields and valleys. We found strong evidence that in the vast majority of cases, Hezbollah fighters left populated civilian areas as soon as the fighting started. We found strong evidence that Hezbollah fired the vast majority of its rockets from pre-prepared positions outside villages. We found strong evidence that in all but a few of the cases of civilian deaths we investigated, Hezbollah fighters had not mixed with the civilian population." Okay. Some of you in the room are skeptics, and skepticism is a healthy intellectual faculty. And so some of you are thinking, well, that's Human Rights Watch. You know, they're a liberal organization. They believe in all of these radical ideas like human rights. Just look at the name of their organization. Let's look at an organization about which we can all agree they don't believe in human rights. The U.S. Army War College did a study of the Lebanon War. And the study was quite interesting because it was based entirely, or almost entirely, on what Israeli participants in the Lebanon War told them that Hezbollah wouldn't cooperate with the U.S. Army War College for obvious reasons. So they asked the Israeli participants, what did you experience during that war with Hezbollah? And they found that, and now I'm quoting the U.S. Army War College, the key battlefields in the land campaign south of the Litani River were mostly devoid of civilians. And IDF, Israeli Army participants, consistently report little or no meaningful intermingling of Hezbollah fighters and non-combatants. But it gets even worse. Nor is there any systematic reporting of Hezbollah using civilians in the combat zone as shields. Everything that about a third to a half of you have heard, and which is constantly repeated, it just never happened. Well, if Israel targeted Lebanese civilian population and infrastructure during the 2006 war, it was not because it had no choice. It could have just fought the Hezbollah, which was not intermingled with the civilian population, not nested among the civilian population. In fact, the Hezbollah was wearing conventional uniforms in Lebanon during the 2006 war. Why did it do it? Because terrorizing the civilian population of Lebanon was a relatively cost-free method of education. And it was much to be preferred over fighting a real foe and suffering heavy casualties. In the case of Lebanon, there wasn't education administered. We have to be honest about that. When Israel began its massacre throughout its massacre in Gaza, the Hezbollah seemed to have limited itself mostly to verbal support. It didn't attempt anything more because it knew if it did, Israel would turn all of Lebanon into a parking lot, and the Hezbollah would lose its popular support. So the education at that level, it was quite successful. Unfortunately for Israel, even though it educated the civilian population, in its main concern, that is to inflict a military defeat on Hezbollah, it failed. In the case of Gaza, I think, in my opinion, it's fair to say that Israel achieved two of its goals. Number one, it did educate the Gaza population, you know, white phosphorus, 1500 degrees on your skin. That's a real education. It did educate the Gazans. And secondly, they did achieve a military victory, so long as we bear in mind what that victory was. As the Israeli columnist who I mentioned earlier, Gideon Levy, put it, he said, the fighting in Gaza was war deluxe. Compared with previous wars, it is child's play. Pilots bombing unimpeded as if on practice runs, tank and artillery soldiers shelling houses and civilians from their armored vehicles, combat engineering troops destroying entire streets in their ominous protected vehicles without facing serious opposition. A large, broad army is fighting against a helpless population and a weak, ragged organization that has fled the conflict zones and is barely putting up a fight. You have to say, to Mr. Friedman's credit, that he's a straight-out thug. He doesn't disguise it. He says we're going to inflict heavy pain on the population of Gaza to educate it. But then there are the others who are less candid, There is a fellow, very, very popular, I'm told. I don't watch TV, but he makes the talk show circuit. He's an expert military analyst. He goes by the name of Anthony Cordesman. How many people have heard of him? Raise your hand. Oh, that's a high recognition. Raise your hand again, I'm curious. Well, that's quite a lot. So Anthony Cordesman, he issued a report about 2 weeks after the Gaza massacre. It was called The Gaza War, a strategic analysis. He has the strategy down pat. And he says in his report that Israel did not violate any of the laws of war. Well, that was a very provocative statement. None? They didn't violate any of the laws of war? Of course, that got me very curious to read on. That's what you call a provocative first sentence, sort of like, call me Ishmael, for those of you who've read Moby Dick. No laws of war it violated. So I'm curious, and I'm reading on. He tells us he did this report after going on Project Interchange. Well, we live in the era of Google, so immediately I Googled Project Interchange, and it came up that it's the American Jewish Committee. So he went in the American Jewish Committee junket. He goes to Israel, and now becomes the heavy research component of his report. He interviews all of these Israeli generals and Israeli spokespersons, and they all told him that Israel didn't violate the laws of war. Well, you could barely come up with more compelling evidence than that. Now, some of you think I'm exaggerating. I saw Jeremy immediately make a note on that, because he's going to call me on it. So I have to be 100% accurate. Otherwise, it's going to be in some international security publication, and I'll be completely discredited. It's true, Cordesman didn't limit himself to statements of Israeli generals and spokespersons. He did the what you call the heavy lifting of a scholar. He read every single press release issued by Israel during those 22 days. He said they contain important insights. In fact, they were so important that he keeps repeating them over and over again, about 7 to 9 pages of his strategic analysis is simply citing Israeli press releases. Well, lo and behold, not one single press release stated that Israel was committing war crimes in Gaza. So what is a sophisticated strategic analysis supposed to conclude? The only reasonable conclusion is, as he says, Israel did not commit any violations of the laws of war during the Gaza massacre. Later on, if you like, I'll be happy to quote to you what the human rights organizations reported after the massacre, and there have already been four major reports issued, quite substantial and very detailed, all of which state that Israel committed war crimes, as did Hezbollah, according to them. But that'll go later. That was Israel's first goal, to restore deterrence capacity, the fear of Israel. Israel's second main goal was to inflict a major defeat on the Hamas, because Hamas was becoming too reasonable. One of the oddest aspects of the Israel-Palestine conflict, and probably the best-kept secret of the conflict, is it's probably the least controversial conflict in the world today. There's no conflict in the world on which there is as broad a consensus, as much agreement on how to resolve it. And there's no dispute whatsoever about the legal principles on the basis of which to resolve the conflict. How many of you have heard of this thing called the two-state settlement? Raise your hand. Good. Now that was a good response. So as you people say, we're on the same page. In my generation, we had the same vibes, but now you're on the same page. Well, what is the two-state settlement? It's pretty straightforward. In fact, it's very straightforward. It says basically three things. Number one, a basic principle of international law is you're not allowed to acquire territory by war. You can't change your borders by virtue of war. Israel acquired the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem during the June 1967 war. Under international law, Israel has no title to any of the West Bank, any of Gaza, or any of East Jerusalem. The highest judicial body in the world, the International Court of Justice, stated in July 2004 that the whole of the West Bank, the whole of Gaza, and the whole of East Jerusalem are, to quote the highest judicial body in the world, they are occupied Palestinian territories. Those are territories designated for Palestinian self-determination. Another fundamental principle of international law, it's Article 2 of the United Nations Charter, that every member state of the United Nations has the right to be free from threats or use of force, and that includes Israel. And therefore, the two-state settlement means the Palestinians should have the right to exercise self-determination in the West Bank and Gaza, with East Jerusalem as their capital, and Israel has the right to be free from any threats or use of force. That means the Arab states have to terminate any threats of belligerency against Israel. And those are the two components. And then the third component of the two-state settlement is that there has to be a resolution of the Palestinian refugee question in accordance with the basic principle of international law, the right to return to their homes and receive compensation. Those are the terms. Okay. A few moments ago, I made an audacious claim. I said, there's no real disagreement about that. There's no real controversy. How can we demonstrate it? I said it rhetorically, but I have an obligation. This is a college audience. I have an obligation to demonstrate it. And in fact, it's very easy to demonstrate because it happens that every year, the United Nations General Assembly votes on a resolution called Peaceful Settlement of the Question of Palestine. And every year, the vote's the same. The whole world on one side, Israel, the United States, and a few South Sea islands and one or another country on the other side. That may sound extreme, but I'm not sure if my language is extreme or if the reality is extreme. So we'll just take the example of 2008. In 2008, consistent with the last 10 years or so, I can give you the numbers for every year if you like, the vote was 164 countries in favor of that two-state settlement, 7 against. The against: Israel, the U.S., Australia, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, and Palau. That's been the vote the last 20 years. To go back literally 20 years ago this year, in October 1989, there was the same vote in the two-state settlement, and the vote was 151-3. the whole world on one side, the United States, Israel, and the island state of Dominica on the other side. The terms of the two-state settlement, as I've just conveyed them, they were upheld, as I said earlier, in July 2004 by the highest judicial body in the world, the International Court of Justice. The ICJ stated, number one, the whole of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem are occupied Palestinian territories. Number two, it stated that the settlements are illegal under international law. And on those propositions, there wasn't a single dissent. There was dissent in the question of the legality of the wall Israel is building. There was one dissent or declaration by the American judge. But on those basic principles, the inadmissibility of acquiring territory by war, the illegality of the settlements, there wasn't a single dissent. As a matter of fact, the one person to cast a negative vote overall, he emphasized in his declaration, he said, there can't be any question. Under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, Paragraph 6, all of those Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. These are not controversial questions in international law. That's the UN, the most representative political body in the world. That's the International Court of Justice, the most respected judicial body in the world. What about those Arab states? Well, the first point to make is Iran voted with that 164 majority this year for the two-state settlement. That's not an Arab state, but it deserves mention. What about the Arab states? Well, March 2002, the Arab League puts forth a peace plan, and the peace plan is the same as what the international community said. Two states, just resolution of the refugee question, but the Arabs go one step further. They said, Israel, just accept these terms, and we will not only terminate belligerency, which is what we're required to do under international law. They said, we will have normal relations with you. We'll have economic relations, we'll have trade, tourism, and so forth. What was the vote in the Arab League? The vote was 22-0. And the Arab League has annually reaffirmed their peace plan for ending the conflict. And then there's finally Hamas. Hamas now says the same. In March 2008, I'll give one example, I could cite many, but for time purposes, I'll give one illustrative example. In March 2008, the head of Hamas's Politburo, Khaled Mishal, he said, there is an opportunity to deal with this conflict in a manner different than Israel and behind it. The U.S. is dealing with it today. There's an opportunity to achieve a Palestinian national consensus on a political program based on the 1967 borders, and this is an exceptional circumstance in which most Palestinian forces, including Hamas, accept a state on the 1967 borders. There is also an Arab consensus on this demand. But, he says, no one is taking advantage of this opportunity. No one is moving to cooperate with this opportunity. Even this minimum that has been accepted by the Palestinians and the Arabs has been rejected by Israel and by the U.S. Well, now Israel has a big problem on its hands. And it's a very big problem. We shouldn't underestimate it, because Israel likes to say it's always in search of an Arab peace partner. It can never find an Arab peace partner. There was that fellow I mentioned to you earlier, Abba Eben, and he famously said, and everybody likes to quote with a snicker, he said, the Arabs never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity for peace. And Israel has always used this as a pretext for refusing to leave the occupied Palestinian territories. There's no one to negotiate with. Now there's a real problem. The whole world agrees on how to resolve the conflict. The terms are upheld by the highest judicial body in the world. The Arab states concur with those terms, in fact, go beyond those terms. And now Hamas is agreeing. This is a problem. And then the problem gets worse, because in June 2008, Hamas enters into a ceasefire with Israel. And according to Israel's official website, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Hamas was, quote, now I'm quoting the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire, although Israel reneged on its obligation under the ceasefire. The terms were, and everyone in this room will understand the terms, Hamas will stop firing its rockets into Israel, but Israel has to lift its strangling blockade on Gaza. Those are the terms. The terms were that Israel would substantially lift that blockade of Gaza. Israel refuses to substantially lift its blockade, but Hamas stubbornly maintains the ceasefire. The official Israeli website continues, the ceasefire was sporadically violated by rocket and mortar shell fire carried out by rogue terrorist organizations. But Hamas tried to enforce the terms of the ceasefire with the other terrorist organizations and tried to prevent them from violating it. Well, now you have a real problem, one which we couldn't possibly overstate the magnitude. Hamas was not just talking moderately, it was acting responsibly. You know, it's often said, how can you trust those Arabs? They may say one thing, but in practice, do something different altogether. But here was Hamas not just talking moderately, but acting moderately, saying, we will respect the ceasefire even if Israel does not lift the blockade. They kept to the ceasefire. It gets worse. The head of Israeli internal security, Yuval Diskin, said Hamas was interested in renewing the ceasefire. Well, now we have a catastrophe. Hamas could be trusted to stand by its word, and it would only be a matter of time before pressure was exerted on Israel. If Hamas is talking moderately, if Hamas is acting responsibly, why not negotiate with it? And for Israel, that's the disaster, because negotiations could only have one possible terminus, ending, and that ending would have to be a full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank, because those are the terms of international law. Those are the terms of the international consensus. The settlements would have to be dismantled, and Israel would have to pack up its bags and leave. That's the law. And that's exactly what Israel desperately sought and seeks to evade. And so Israel had only one option. The option was to go in, hopefully overthrow Hamas, or radicalize it. And so Hamas will become so radicalized as a result of the devastation Israel wrought that it will refuse to negotiate with Israel, and then Israel can say to the usual snickers, all those Arabs, they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity for peace. Strangely, this isn't the first time this happened. It's actually the second time. It wasn't Islamic fundamentalists. The problem the first time was those radical Arab nationalists. In the late 1970s, the main Palestinian representative organization was called the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. And beginning in the late 1970s, the PLO said, we're ready to negotiate a two-state settlement of the conflict. The PLO, which had conflicts with Israel not in the south, but in the north, because it was headquartered not in Gaza, but in Lebanon at the time, in July 1981, Israel negotiated a ceasefire with the PLO. As I speak, just notice the words, the repetition. They negotiated in July 1981 a ceasefire. In August 1981, that same Arab League, it put forth a peace plan. It wasn't called, as the new one was called in March 2002, it was called the Abdullah Peace Plan, named after Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. It was called the Fahd Peace Plan, named after Crown Prince Fahd of Saudi Arabia. It was the same thing, a two-state settlement. So, the PLO, it says it's ready to settle on the June 67 border. PLO negotiates a ceasefire. Arab League, it says it's ready to endorse a two-state settlement. It was put forth in August 1981 and then confirmed by the Arab League in 1982. So, what does Israel do? Has a real problem. It's that same problem which keeps recurring for Israel, that Palestinian moderation. And we have it from a very good Israeli scholar, he's no longer around, a mainstream scholar named Avner Yaniv. He wrote a book on the June 82 war called Dilemmas of Security. For those of you who are too young to remember, Israel periodically invades and destroys Lebanon. There have been, I think, five major invasions now. 1978, Operation Litani. 1982, Operation Grapes of Wrath. 1993, Operation, 1982, Operation Peace in the Galilee. 1993, Operation Grape Accountability. 1996, Operation Grapes of Wrath. And then the one in July, August 2006. In June 82, they invade Lebanon, and the estimates are between June and September 1982, they killed between 18,000 and 20,000 Palestinian and Lebanese, overwhelmingly civilians. Why do they do it? 18,000 to 20,000 Palestinians and Palestinians and Lebanese, overwhelmingly civilians. That's quite a bloodletting. Why do they do it? And why they did it is exactly why they went into Gaza. The problem was, as Avner Yaniv puts it, that he says the PLO was ready for a historic compromise with Israel, but Israel opposed a Palestinian state. So, what is Israel to do? He says Israel's strategy was the following. It mounted punitive military raids, now I'm quoting him word for word, deliberately out of proportion against Palestinian and Lebanese civilians in order to weaken PLO moderates, strengthen the hand of Arafat's radical rivals, and guarantee the PLO's inflexibility. If you keep killing civilians, pressure builds on the PLO to not negotiate with Israel. That's the strategy. Weaken PLO moderates, strengthen the radicals, guarantee the PLO's inflexibility by killing Palestinian and Lebanese civilians. Problem was this Arafat guy, he was very stubborn. He kept saying, I'm ready to negotiate the two-state settlement. And then Israel has only two options, according to Professor Yaniv. The options are a historic compromise with the Palestinians or military action against it. And he says Israel decide to attack Why did it attack? He said, it's an interesting phrase he comes up with. It's worth putting in your memory bank. He said it was because of the Palestinians' peace offensive. That was the problem. Those nasty, diabolical peace offensives. And he says the Israeli invasion had been preceded, note again the exact parallel with Hamas, by more than a year of effective ceasefire with the PLO. Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire in 1981 and 82. There was a year of effective ceasefire with the PLO. Finally, Israel is getting desperate. It had laid plans to attack. It needs a pretext. It needs an excuse. So it goes into Lebanon in one of its last raids, kills 200 civilians, including 60 occupants of a Palestinian children's hospital. The pressure now builds on the PLO to retaliate. They fire some shells, and there's a single Israeli casualty. And now Israel has its pretext. It's interesting, the parallels. It's not rocket attacks from the south. In 1982, the pretext was shelling from the north. And so Israel goes into Lebanon under the banner of Operation Peace in the Galilee. Was it the shelling that was the reason? Yaniv says, of course not. He says, the raison d'etre, the purpose of the entire operation, the one which left 18 to 20,000 Lebanese and Palestinians dead, was destroying the PLO as a political force capable of claiming a Palestinian state on the West Bank. That was the problem. We have to prevent any kind of diplomatic settlement which will force us to leave the West Bank. That was the raison d'etre of the entire operation. And that now brings us to the present, where I'll leave off in a half moment. We come to 2008, Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni. She says in December 2008 that although Israel wants to create a temporary ceasefire with Hamas, it does not want a long-term ceasefire with Hamas. Why? She says, quote, it harms the Israeli strategic goal, empowers Hamas, and gives the impression that Israel recognizes the movement. And that's exactly right. If there is an extended ceasefire, Hamas acts responsibly. Hamas keeps to its commitment to a two-state settlement, then Israel's strategic goal of keeping the West Bank is undermined. So, as far back as March 2007, Israel decided it had to attack Hamas. It enters into a ceasefire in June 2008. The Israelis were remarkably honest about what they were doing. Ehud Barak, the defense minister, why did he enter into the ceasefire? The Israelis report, quote, because the Israeli army needed time to prepare the attack. Once all the pieces were in place, all that Israel needed was the pretext, how to provoke Hamas so they'll attack. And the pretext was easy enough to do. They waited until November 4th, the American election day, when everyone's attention was riveted on the outcome of the US elections. And on that day, they go into Gaza, kill 6 Palestinian militants, knowing full well it's going to evoke a Palestinian attack, retaliation, and then they have their excuse for going in to Gaza and committing the massacre. The Israeli official website acknowledges Hamas launched its rocket attacks in retaliation for what Israel did on November 4th. And now Israel can embark on yet another murderous invasion in order to foil, in order to defeat yet another of those nasty, diabolical Palestinian peace offensives. Okay, that's the story.
You've been listening to a talk by Norman Finkelstein at the University of Connecticut, April 7th. To hear the entire talk, you can visit Talk Nation Radio's webpage, talknationradio.org. This coming Wednesday at our usual time, 5 p.m., we feature our interview with the editor of Le Monde Diplomatique, Alan Gresh. I'm Dory Smith. Thanks for listening.